Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all to the Northwest this evening and the Ulster Medical Society for Professor Took's lecture. A few housekeeping issues. There is dinner after the meeting, and you'd be all very welcome to stay. I think a number of you have already registered. And it's with great pleasure that we welcome Professor Atkinson, the President of the Ulster Medical Society.
Well, thank you very much. I think this is a very important evening each year for the Ulster Medical Society. There's a tradition going back many years of having an out-of-town meeting here in the Northwest, and we're very grateful to the people in the Postgraduate Centre who work so hard. Alison Heath has been the person who's been doing a lot of the work for this evening, and I'm not sure if she's here or not, but we're very much indebted to her for all the work that she's done. So it's very, very nice to be here and to have the Ulster Medical Society here tonight. And as you know, tonight is a special memorial lecture for Desmond White. And many people here wouldn't have met Desmond White. I happened to meet him as a very young SHO working for Frank Pantridge. And he was a great mate of Prof Pantridge's, because they had a similar background during the war in Burma. I think they had already known each other from Queens, and he worked behind enemy lines there. He got a DSO, he came back, he came up to Alton McElvin, set up the Postgraduate Medical Centre, and set up a very fine department of radiology, which was always renowned. Frank Pantridge, always a bit scurrilous, as those who know him would acknowledge, said if you really wanted to get a chest x-ray, you had to come up to Alton McElvin. You couldn't get a decent chest x-ray like Desmond White did up here. So it's very nice that in honour of a very fine man, that this lecture has been named after Desmond White, and we remember him very fondly tonight. It's now my great pleasure to introduce to the Ulster Medical Society and to everyone here tonight, Sir John Took. John Took is between jobs at the moment, although I can see his first slide from here, and he's moved on already. But on the 30th of November, he finished his work, which was as the Dean of the Peninsular College of Medicine and Dentistry. And he really set up that new medical school, worked extremely hard, and brought it to the fore very rapidly. Over those years that he has been there, he held, and before that, an honorary consultant appointment with the Royal Devon and Exeter NHS Foundation Trust in diabetes and in vascular medicine, and he remains clinically active. Between jobs, as I say, but in January 2010, he takes up a very important post as Vice Provost in Health and Head of the Medical School at University College London. He's the immediate past Chair of the Medical Schools Council, Chair of the UK Healthcare Education Advisory Committee, a member of the National Institute for Health Research Advisory Board and the Health and Education National Strategic Exchange. As you know, in 2006 he led a high-level group for the Chief Medical Officer on overcoming barriers to clinical effectiveness, and in 2008 he chaired the independent inquiry into the modernising medical careers, leading to the publication of Aspiring in Excellence, which is so important when we see around us very often a trend towards mediocrity in many areas of life. He was recently also invited by government to join a high-level panel representing medicine on fair access to the professions, who set out their first report, Unleashing Aspirations, in July 2009. It's very good of Sir John to take time to come and talk to us here. It's very apt. Somebody was just reminding us that just in the last week, all of the advertisements have gone in for the various SDR jobs into the BMJ. So John has told me that he's not speaking in any government capacity tonight because he's moved on from that and is now a new chair of the new board Chris Edwards, another endocrinologist, I might say. But he will be giving us his thoughts on postgraduate education. The third lecture of that will be by the man who succeeded Sir John as chair of the Medical Schools Council, Tony Wheatman from Sheffield, who's coming to talk to us. I can't remember whether it's in February or March. So you'll want to twin that with your next visit to Belfast, or your next visit to Belfast, because I just want to remind you that the annual dinner of the Ulster Medical Society is on Friday the 5th of February, and we've got some very good speakers coming to that, and we'd be delighted to have a good turnout that night. So again, Sir John, you're very welcome here tonight, and we're looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Can you all hear me at the back without the microphone? Because otherwise I'll be getting myself in a muddle. It's a real pleasure to be invited here today, and thank you so much for the kind invitation. My interest in postgraduate education, other than that I think all consultants have who work with trainees, was of course heightened by this event. 2007, MTAS was the precipitate, but as somebody pointed out to me at the time, MTAS, the selection process, acted as a lightning rod for deeper concerns within the profession at that time. And key amongst those, I think, were a sense in medicine of deprofessionalisation and of lack of clinical engagement in key decision making. And when we undertook the inquiry, those feelings became even more manifest and resulted in one of our key findings, and one of the most worrying from my perspective, was that there was lack of clarity about the doctor's role. And that was heightened by observations from the Secretary of State for Health, who had proclaimed that trainees were becoming increasingly supernumerary. In other words, there was a negation of the real service contribution that people in training positions make. And of course, there was still lack of resolution of what the specialist, the CCT holder, was actually going to contribute in the future. And all of this, I think, against the background of a deficient acknowledgement of what the doctor brings to the contemporary healthcare team. Now, we could discuss why that may have occurred and why there was this sense of deprofessionalisation. I think a lot of it stemmed actually from the failings of the very few, which were highly publicised around the turn of the century, which I think put the profession on the back foot and made it very difficult for the profession to assert its true role and its role in the healthcare team. Perhaps we can talk about that later. But what is clear is that if you don't have clarity about the role the doctor takes on, it's impossible to pursue outcome-focused medical education. If you don't know what you're preparing people for, how can you devise a sensible educational program? And furthermore, if you don't know what individual members of the healthcare team are going to contribute, how can you plan your workforce in any meaningful way? And, of course, you can't understand what the individual needs to excel at if you don't know what their role is. So I make no apology for starting a discussion on postgraduate medical education, or indeed undergraduate medical education, by saying without role clarity, it's very difficult to move forward. And I want, therefore, to consider with you, for a while, if I may, not what the past role, the historic role of the doctor has been, but what the future role of the doctor should be, because after all, we're preparing people for a changing context. But we nonetheless have to ask, what are the abiding attributes that you would expect a doctor to have? Now, I split those into generic qualities, qualities and attributes that you would expect to see in any healthcare professional, and those which you can regard as not necessarily specific for medicine, but they're must-haves, they're obligatory attributes that society would wish to see in their doctor. And when I say prepare for the future, I think it's sobering to realise that as a species, we tend to underestimate the pace of change. And I put up some predictions here from certain luminaries just to illustrate that point. Bill Gates, 640K ought to be enough for anybody. It's a clear underestimate. But this is what we do. We don't realise the pace of change, and therefore we're likely to not prepare adequately for changing environments. And in considering change, there's a number of dimensions one can look at. There's, of course, demography, economy, technological capacity, and allied to that, public expectation. Now, as Brewer said, I've recently left a role in the West Country. The detail doesn't matter here. The black slice at the top is the growth in people over the age of 65, which is essentially doubling between 1980 and 1926. So a huge demographic shift, of which, of course, we're all aware, but our health services, and certainly our social care services, are yet to catch up with. Now, it's not just that we'll be dealing, and the doctor of tomorrow will be dealing with a more aging population. It's the economic impact of this, because whereas now there's roughly one elderly retired person for every four people in work, by 2025 it's going to be one for three. So there's a huge shift occurring here, which is going to impact on the public purse and therefore have a profound effect really on the way that health services will have to be organised in the interests of cost efficiency. Because the other driver here is the fact that healthcare costs with increasing technological capacity are changing very rapidly as well. This graph, this divergence that you can see there, is the total spending on health, the blue line, and the dotted orange line is gross domestic product for the OECD countries. So for all OECD countries, there is this divergence between how much the country is earning and what health costs are there. Currently, in the UK, we spend about 9% of GDP on health. In the States, it's something like 15 to 16%. If you extrapolate that, by the end of this century, the US is spending 100% of GDP on health, which is clearly nonsense. But it simply makes the point that this is an unsustainable divergence that we have between the amount of money coming in and the amount that health can cost. And of course, part of that is technological capacity. We can do more. And science will not stop because of the financial constraints. Just to illustrate how advances are likely to impact even further, I choose the question of what derives from the Human Genome Project. And of course, it's not about gene substitution. It's about being able to undertake better risk profiling, perhaps be able to target drugs better through the use of pharmacogenomics. But more importantly, if you understand what gene is responsible for something and you can work out the function of that gene, it gives you new insights into new molecular targets from which new treatments are derived. But it's not just therapy that will, I think, be the end result. It's actually preventive care as well. Now, there are some, I know there are some endocrinologists in the audience, but there are also probably general practitioners, and many of us are faced with this assertion, are we not, when we see somebody with morbid obesity. It's not my fault, it's my genes, it's my glands, where, of course, in the absence of anything else, we have said, well, we know that's not the case. But do we? Because colleagues of mine in the Peninsula Medical School identified the common variant in the FTO gene, common, present in 1/6 of the population, which predisposes to overweight and obesity. It's detected because it's one of the genes that gene variants is known to predispose towards diabetes, but diabetes was simply driven by the propensity to weight gain. Now, I simply mention this to say, once you're able to understand the function of that gene, and it looks as though it works on satiety, I would put it to you that there will be treatments, preventative treatments made available to manipulate the function that is relatively disturbed in that proportion of the population. That said, because of the importance of the role of the doctor to the deliberations about education, one of the outcomes of the MMC inquiry was the holding of consensus conference a little over a year ago, which involved all of these bodies, as well as, I might add, members of the public. So this was an open event and a very broad event. And just review some of the findings from that. The generic attributes that I referred to, those features that you would expect to find not only in doctors but in any healthcare professional, included, of course, good communication skills, ability to work as part of a team, non-judgmental behaviour, empathy, and, of course, integrity. The must-haves, the obligatory attributes, first and foremost was clinical reasoning that underpins the process of diagnosis. Then the concept that the doctor has to synthesize and integrate information that comes in from a variety of different sources and act as an interpreter of that information, not just for the patient, but in relationship to other healthcare professionals and colleagues. The capacity to handle risk and uncertainty, so be able to work off protocol and use experience and judgment to know how to do that. The capacity to assume a leadership role doesn't imply that the doctor is always the leader of the team, but must have the capacity to assume that role where appropriate, and the confidence to take ultimate responsibility for clinical decisions. And I gained some assurance that these things were right from a YouGov poll. You're probably all familiar with YouGov poll. It's a system whereby you can sample stratified sections of society that we know to be typical in demographic and social class terms to the generality of the UK population. And we use this device to test out some of the assertions. And you can see, as a chart very clearly, but the majority of people strongly agree that this confidence in the doctor as a diagnostician is absolutely critical part of the role. Now, one of the other things that came through really strongly was the concept that historically and now doctors have a role and a responsibility for enhancing clinical services, pushing the boundaries of health through their positions of leadership and responsibility. Now, for some, doctors, that enhancement is simply doing their job better on a day-by-day basis through reflective practice and learning how they might do things better. And that's, of course, absolutely fine. Others will be promoting enhancement through team performance, but then others still will be involved in education, in research, in management and leadership. And this is, I think, very much acknowledged as part of the role. More contentious was the idea that when resources are tight, and as we look forward, that's likely to ever more be the case, in the medium term at least, then doctors have a role in terms of determining how resources are used. And what came out in the debate was that, of course, it's easy for a doctor to hide behind their patient advocacy and say, well, I've got to treat the person in front of me to the exclusion of everything else. But all of us involved in clinical services know that the time and resource you give the person in front of you has an impact on the 100 people waiting outside the consulting room door. And I don't think this is something the doctor of the future can shy away from and necessarily hide behind the patient advocacy perspective. There's a balance to be struck here. But interestingly, when you ask society, they anticipate that doctors will play a role in the distribution of resources, not on their own, obviously in consultation with society and policymakers. But it really is, an important thing to consider how much the doctor should be contributing to such debates. If we don't contribute to it, then resource arbitration is going to be a subject of political as opposed to political imperative as opposed to clinical dealing with complexity and comorbidity is again something that it is assumed as critically important for the doctor, and with the demographic shift, with the growth in chronic disease, and what many people don't appreciate is that chronic diseases now are in the red colours, are the major causes of death, not only in the developed world, but the developing world. So I was always under the impression that it would be infection and malnutrition that would be the dominant causes of death in the developing world. That's been overtaken now by the huge swathe of chronic disease afflicting those populations as well. The idea that a doctor, as part of their role, needs to be research aware also came through. This doesn't mean that everybody has to be a researcher, but the fact that there is a considerable drive for evidence-based practice, which is likely to get greater given the resource constraints, the fact that more patients are in trials, and I would suggest to you that in many of your professional lifetimes we'll see lesser dependence on the controlled clinical trial than there has been in the past, simply because to do large-scale clinical trials when the therapeutic margins are getting smaller and therefore the trials have to be bigger, it simply becomes too expensive. So you then get into an ethical dilemma. Is it best not to even consider trialing a particular therapy or introducing it, or do we produce new devices to introduce treatments in a controlled way with selected groups of patients? And my suggestion to you is that that's what will happen over the next 10 years or so. And of course that means that practitioners will have to be part of that evaluative framework that treatments are to be used in that way. And then, again, reflecting the economic climate we find ourselves in, there is no doubt that the collapse of the finance sector within the UK that the knowledge economy and the life science industries are going to become increasingly important for our economy. And I have no qualms about speaking about the economy as a doctor, because we all know the very close relationships between the health and the wealth of our population. So I think the need to sustain a strong biomedical research base in the UK means that research awareness amongst doctors has sort of become more of a premium than perhaps it has over the last 10 to 15 years. Clinical leadership I've already alluded to, but the work I did on barriers to clinical effectiveness made it, I think, very clear to me that the barriers are context specific. They relate to the particular environment, particular team, particular condition, at a particular locality. And if that's the case, and the evidence suggests that that is the case, then top-down control, central directives, are never going to overcome those local contextual situations. And local ownership and local clinical engagement and local leadership therefore become critically important if you are to improve health services. Again, the public have a view on this, although it's sometimes the medical profession has been somewhat ambivalent about promoting its role as a leader. Society has a pretty clear view that the doctor is not invariably but usually the leader of the medical healthcare team. In my last role, was involved in creating a school of dentistry, and it always amuses me when I reflect on the doctor's role as a leader. Does anybody ever question the dentist's role as a leader of the dental healthcare team? It would never be entertained, but we sometimes seem to be diffident about suggesting that on many occasions it's appropriate for the doctor to lead the medical team. So against that backdrop, let's consider what the implications for postgraduate medical education and training are in the 21st century. And I want to pose to you a series of questions. Does the experience they have prepare them for the health problems, the changes resulting from demography, etc., of the 21st century? Are we equipping trainees to deal with risk and uncertainty in a rapidly changing world? And perhaps most importantly, are we equipping trainee doctors to enhance their individual contributions along the lines that I've suggested to you? Well, of course, the MTAS and MMC problems would suggest that things weren't quite right, and you will have seen the report, and I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but simply to say these, along with the absence of clarity about the role of the doctor, were the main findings. Policy malalignment, what that simply meant was that the principles and objectives of MMC were not aligned with the stated policy objectives of the Department of Health towards more care in the community, greater emphasis on chronic disease, a greater emphasis on patient empowerment and so forth. These things weren't being reflected in the training programs that were being developed. No doubt that the government's process for the introduction of MMC, and particularly MTAS, were seriously awry. The risk management of the process, the lack of trialing and so forth were dire, quite frankly. By patchy quality management, we meant that the function of the postgraduate deanery function was delivered variably across the UK. In some places it was very good. And I say this, whichever devolved administration I was in, devolved administrations I think manage things much better, I suspect, because of scale and the type tighter knit relationships between deaneries, service, and medical schools. Poor workforce planning is probably an understatement. Of course, around this time, it triggered a whole set of discussions as to whether workforce planning was ever possible. And I remember something Cyril Charlton said to me during the health workforce for London discussions, along the lines that the great thing about no workforce planning is when the disaster comes, there has been no preceding anxiety. But I'm not sure that's a responsible approach to take, but I think, you know, optimal workforce planning, I think it's going to be better than none. And we're dealing here with UK-wide resource. It simply can't be left for certain specialty areas that are totally unprovided for. The complex regulatory framework we identified as the fact that there's PMetB and there's GMC. GMC, of course, as you know, regulating undergraduate medical education and playing a role in CPD and the ultimately revalidation, with PMetB doing the bit in the middle. Now, that may have been all right if the personalities and the philosophies of the heads of the two bits were working in union, but can you imagine what it would have been like had different educational philosophies arisen with those two organisations? And then, of course, finally, the inflexibility and non-aspirational nature of the training mechanism. So does their clinical experience prepare them for the problems of the 21st century? Well, I would argue not very well. We're talking about postgraduate education, but if you look at undergraduate medical education, well, the majority of clinical experience is still in the hospital sector. In my medical school in the West Country, we pushed the boundaries pretty hard and we got it up to about 30-35% was in the community setting. In a typical London medical school that I'm going to, it's 15%. So the exposure that students get to the career area where most of them will be entering, will be changes in patterns of care, doesn't mirror that future. Similarly, the foundation program, although in its introductory statements makes play of the fact that chronic disease is now an important health burden for our country and for other countries, the rest of the curriculum really pays scant attention to it, and the focus is on the management of the acutely unwell person. Genetics, which is bound to become a far more important part of all of our experience, doesn't figure in that program at all. And modern genetics will not be delivered by clinical geneticists. It will require every medical practitioner and other health professionals having a more profound understanding of genetics and gene-environment interaction. GP training, restricted to 3 years, one of the few countries in Europe where the length of training is as short as it is. And yet, this idea that a society with high public expectation of what health service can offer will be satisfied with that when care moves even further into a community setting. And all of this compounded by the impact of the European Working Time Directive, which of course threatens the acquisition of experience on which judgment relies. And I put it to you again that in the context of the demographic shifts, with significantly more comorbidity and more complexity, that experience, that building up of one's clinical capital to draw upon in such circumstances is going to become increasingly important. Are we equipping trainee doctors to enhance their contribution? Well, these are just, I've already referred to the director of workforce. This concern about the second foundation here being something of a mark in time was a deep concern to us during the inquiry. Now, I'm very aware that the quality of the foundation program varies from place to place, and I think where the people have worked well and hard at it, and particularly where FY2 becomes more themed than in a sense as an entry into specialist training, it can be a strong experience. But I think the foundation program is going to be under review, currently is being considered by John Collins. That will be an important part of the revision, I think, that's necessary. But I just want to focus for a few moments on to what extent medical education inculcates this sense that doctors should be involved in pushing the boundaries of healthcare, and suggest to you that there are at least three issues that get in the way of that, of the way we structure things at the moment. And one of them is risk aversion. Now I think in part this is an unintended consequence of a focus over the last decade or more on patient safety. Now it's very difficult to argue against patient safety, and there's no doubt that it's been an important driver for improvement in quality of services. But nonetheless, it can begin to promote the idea that ultimate safety is possible, and deny the fact that there is inherent risk in medical activity. Being ill is a risky business, and yet there's almost a sense that society can be insulated from all this and be led to believe that this can, things can be 100% safe. Or indeed a screening test can be 100% specific. Clearly it's nonsense, but it's the culture that has been developed. I'm intrigued to see how, having established that culture of the health service, a risk-averse culture, how we're going to respond to the new drive for innovation. Because innovation is risky. You know, you're doing something that's relatively untried, it's in that context. And it would be very interesting to see whether we have a health service that is imaginative enough, responsive enough to take on that challenge. Risk aversion, I would suggest, is also a barrier to earlier adoption of earlier involvement in clinical practice. You see this in the States with medical students where now, you know, they're not allowed to do anything for fear that they might do somebody harm. How many people in the room did a student locum when they were training, when they were a medical student? So possibly half. And how many of you saw that as a very valuable experience? I mean, every time I ask this question, that's the sort of response one gets. Yeah, it's a very fulfilling, it's one of the first times you realise what the role was actually about, and you grew in confidence, and you were properly supervised, and probably took some risks, but it went pretty well. Of course, if we are going to, as I'll go on to say in a moment, we're going to combat EWTD, one of the things we need to do is fast forward the acquisition of skill and experience and think about reintroducing such experiences again. The latest Tomorrow's Doctors, which some of you I'm sure maybe the lesson is being learned. Another barrier is what I call research binary divide. I've already alluded to this in the need for greater research awareness in the medical workforce. But essentially what we now have is those who see research as the part of their career, probably 5%, 4-5% of the medical workforce, and everybody else who doesn't. Now that's a big change from certainly when I was first a consultant, where most people would have had a doctorate and many people would have pursued some clinical research as part of their role. It's problematic now because of research bureaucracy. So if you're only doing all this on a very part-time basis, to get over the hurdles to actually generate sufficient momentum to do anything is extremely trying. I think we have a real problem in that regard. And we also have a problem that we've had a burgeoning of medical student numbers and this relative decline in clinical academic staff numbers. In fact, the latest survey shows that unless we refuel that pipeline, in 10 years' time through retirements, myself included, there will be a 15% reduction in the number of clinical academics. Now, people say, well, we've got all these academic fellow programs and everything else, but we have no idea what the conversion rate is for those programs. What conversion rate is from somebody doing a doctorate going into clinical academia. So I think there's still a great, great vulnerability here in terms of clinical academic careers. And then, of course, the final area is that of competence. And again, a bit like safety, competence is difficult to argue against. Of course, we want doctors to be competent, but I suggest you we want them to be more than competent. We want them to have clinical expertise, which is founded on the combination of competence to do technical things, to do tasks, but also to have the experience and, more importantly, the judgment to know when to use those competencies. So it's an amalgam of different sets of skills that are really required. Now, as you know, and just look at the red line, you're all familiar with it. This was run through training, the review, and to a larger extent still the case, where trainees are selected into one of 57 specialties and subspecialties, and off they go, with relative lack of flexibility, little attention paid to enhancing the enhancement roles that the doctor might subsequently take on. And again, you won't be able to see the detail, but what we suggested as a result of the inquiry was a broader core specialty training, perhaps four core areas, to give clinicians a broader base to their training, such that if they were required to reinvent themselves later in their career, they would have a foundation on which to fall back on. It wouldn't be like snakes and ladders, where you have to go back to the beginning again and get in this narrow pipe stem to actually progress as a very, very narrow specialist. And related to that was the idea that during that core training, you could also have options to undertake skilling in, for example, research, education, management, public health. And we've not talked about public health advocacy, but I see that as a very important part of the role moving forward. And so those are the proposals that we've made, and they are now subject to Medical Education England deliberations. also suggested that to lift the quality of postgraduate medical education training, the idea of contestability, in other words, the money for education has to reward excellent training, and that will be played out possibly through the provider, commissioner, a split. And then professionalising training. It's we still have the situation, of course, where busy clinicians are expected to take on the training role, the job plans don't necessarily afford sufficient time, and the training in the educational function is relatively deficient. There are moves afoot to try and address that. The Academy of Medical Educators are currently involved in a project to identify what the training resources currently are, what the needs are, develop a curriculum for educational supervisors, pilot that, and then see what the implications are for implementing that. But it seems absolutely clear to me that one of the responses to EWTB has to be great professionalisation training as well as fast forwarding, and therefore we need to invest in skilling clinicians to play their part in that. The other measure, of course, is this idea that you have modular credentialing, so you build on your core experience in perhaps an incremental way, taking a relatively narrow focus, because that's the only way you can accrue sufficient experience in a specialist area. Now, again, I'm not going to go through the detail of this, but you'll know that in our final report, we suggested that none of this could happen in a coherent way unless there were a body which was largely medical-led, but was going to ensure coherence. Coherence in terms of the principles underpinning postgraduate medical education and training, policy coherence, so that general health policy and education policy aligned, that there was real intelligence about the workforce numbers required, that reflected technological advance and other changes, and that the postgraduate deanery function was better aligned with service and academic effort. Medical education has been formed. You've heard that Chris Edwards is the chair. It's about 6-9 months into its life, and I think it's beginning to tackle some of the issues which have really not been tackled since we published the report. But as the eternal optimist, I think there's a good chance that they will make pretty rapid progress now. So I've covered a lot of ground, but what I hope I've convinced you is that we have to envisage the doctor's role and the education that underpins that in a rapidly changing context. It's no good saying, well, this is what it used to be like, let's try and recreate the past. So clarity about the doctor's role is absolutely critical. And it's critical that education takes account of health policy imperatives more generally, and that we work very closely to assure that's the case. The educational structures and processes need to match that, but also need to be developed such that they can cope with the huge challenges of the European Working Time Directive. And yes, aspire to excellence, but define what excellence is. It's just not just a vague aspiration. We've had to identify what we think people should be excelling at. And then, critically, we must ensure that those doing the training have the resources and skills to actually benefit the training. Thank you very much.
friend for your lecture, Sir John, and I'm sure Sir John will be happy to ask questions. Maybe I'll start off with one while you're all getting your questions. You obviously, I hope I'm not reading too much, not a great fan of the F2 year, and the 3 year course of basically training, which is maybe not something that we're all fairly familiar with. Do you want to tell us a wee bit more about that and why that was the thing four different modules, isn't that?
Yes, I mean, I think the first thing you have to recognise here is that we have a medical act which requires registration after the first year of the foundation programme. There were arguments for and against creating a 2 year programme. I'm not sure it was actually adequately discussed, as with many reforms of postgraduate training, when the 2 year programme was introduced, but that's what happened. I think what drove us to consider a 1 year foundation, in other words, a recreation of a carefully constructed pre-registration year which fused very tightly with the fifth year of undergraduate medicine, was in fact the impact of EWTD, and that there just wasn't the luxury to allow people to drift for that period, given that, you know, every year was precious in terms of accruing experience. The difficulty you run into, of course, is that people, and what F2 I think was trying to address, was that many young doctors won't know what they want to do. About 50% of people at the end of their pre-registration year know what they want to do. And hence this idea, well, if you gave them a few options, then that may help them. Now, it could do if they were given an array of options which met vaguely their aspirations. And in good centres, that happened. In others, it didn't. And they were having experiences which were of no interest to them whatsoever. I think if you're going to deal with the career option issue, you have to be far more deliberate about it and address it head on. So, and that means in medical school prospectuses, we should be revealing what proportion of doctors do what, so that medical students don't come out of medical school thinking 50% of them are going to become surgeons, because they're not. That it's very realistic about the number that will go into general practice, and we need to reinforce that through medical undergraduate education, and we need to offer very good career advice during that whole period. Now, I suspect if you do that and you use special study units within medical school to actually expose students to concentrated in-depth experience within different specialties, you will improve on that 50%. Now, still not everybody will know what they want to do, but that's where having a core programme, which means and some form of accreditation for prior learning, such that if you, okay, you did the wrong core, it's not the end of your career. You can APEL, you can accredit some of that into another core programme, or you go towards your specialty training. I think it's a better way to go.
First up, thank you for an excellent talk.
Thank you.
My name is Paul Bayliss. I'm an AD consultant here in Derry, and I'm the Foundation Programme Director here in Derry. I'd like to specifically ask you about the money.
Yeah.
Towards the end, you alluded to, sorry to degenerate the conversation to the filthy lucre, but the reality is that postgraduate education is a coalition of the willing. Instead of the health service,
yeah,
for friends in GP, it's particular people that
absolutely
excel and want to do it.
Absolutely.
You talk about professionalising it. Well, the
yeah
reality is, until the money flows with it,
yeah,
it isn't ever going to get the focus from
absolutely
the individuals and from the organisation. I'm interested that Medical Education England, fortunately not Medical Education UK, sitting here in Northern Ireland, but Medical Education England is on the march.
Yeah.
And I read your report, and that was the thing that struck out at the end.
Yeah.
This talk about money following the training.
Yeah.
When do you think that's going to change? Do you think it's going to change, and if so, when?
I don't think you'll cope with any of this without proper incentivisation.
Right.
And job plans that reflect an educational commitment. I mean, that's the absolute bottom line on all of this. On the incentivisation stuff, actually, there are a number of bits in place now. At the highest level, the NHS constitution now states what was always the case, actually, the NHS, that the NHS isn't simply about service, it's about education and research. That was in the founding principles of the NHS, and they've been reasserted in the constitution. The Quality Care Commission will also start to look at education as part of its measures of hospitals' performance. But probably the most critical thing is, which the chief executives look at, is the operating framework for the NHS, which again makes reference to education. So, if you like, the policy environment and the incentives at that level are there, it's the money. And I think that my worry about the money is that it's unrealistic to see the envelope of money increasing in the next decade. It's going to be distributed differently. That may the best view of that is that, you know, places that are really good are going to get more of the resource. There are going to be problems then with service impact of trainees not being everywhere. My real worry is that unless we really promote what the critical role of the doctor is, you will see a lot more role substitution as the cost-efficient way of dealing with what we're faced with.
You said role substitution. One of your points about the doctor was taking clinical ownership.
Exactly.
And with respect to perhaps the people in other roles, don't expect them to do it.
Absolutely.
It's not in their culture
absolutely right. And what most people fail to acknowledge with role substitution is that the good studies, and there aren't that many good studies, but the good studies suggest that role substitution is not more cost effective. And the reason it isn't is because as soon as something goes off protocol, which of course is what happens with elderly people and with complex comorbidity, you need to bring somebody else in to sort it out. And you know, if I just amplify that a bit more, most of the studies of role substitution, simply because of experimental design, are done in narrow areas of medicine where protocol application is relatively easy. They're not looking at unselected stuff that is the nature of most of medicine.
Yeah, but on your point, the triaging in medicine and nursing problem by nurses,
yeah,
to me, over the past 40 years, seems to have slowed things up.
Right.
I mean, because that's role substitution.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the generalisation.
Yeah.
And the other point I wanted to ask you about was, you were mentioning about the students, the internships, and if they brought those down and got the internship then to be 1 year, back here, and then as you suggested, having multiple specialist based
yeah.
training programs for 2 years that could
yeah.
have a spiral
yeah.
outlet into six or seven different specialist
yeah.
design programs for
yeah.
that area, but it may be more efficient to use
indeed.
The knowledge that
yeah.
it takes to produce
yeah.
an efficient doctor.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly very much the philosophy behind our thinking. I mean, I find it interesting the role substitution bit plays out across medicine. Because in acute medicine, there's now a greater emphasis on putting the most highly skilled person at the front end to undertake that triage. In other parts of the health service, and certainly in certain primary care settings, then the nurse will be the front line. And, well, I mean, you all have views on which is the more effective and more efficient way of doing things. I think it does need to be very carefully considered.
It's great to see so many younger doctors here. They're all getting younger than me. But it'd be lovely to have your thoughts on the training. People have just finished their training, people in the middle of their training. Thoughts on flexibility, questions about the talk tonight. Anybody want to put their hand up and ask this one? I know there are other people who want to make a guess, please.
Then you have an NHS that's completely organised into separate camps and trusts that actually are in competition with each other for the resources of these various doctors, and also for the resources of the trainees to allow them to hit their targets to make. So the overall ethos of the NHS and the overall ethos of service delivery and standards and the overall ethos of training, which is all of it excellent in doing the best for everybody. Actual practice of this is completely, completely counterintuitive. I think, the question is, where did workforce planning fall into all this in terms of training and in terms of delivery of service? Because the two are interdependent, and there's no way to enforce workforce planning and therefore to enforce training.
I agree entirely with your comments about the difficulty of having equity of service delivery in a market forces system. It seems difficult to me to align equity or to choice. Actually, I don't see how you can make that triangle work. That aside, I think there are real difficulties with workforce planning in that environment, because of course we are already seeing some trusts, particularly in England, hesitating to involve themselves in training and in a sense take on their national responsibility for the collective provision of a number of trained specialists, because it's not in their individual interest to do so. And the same is true, that's why I think it does need to be some central oversight, such that sufficient numbers of people are brought to produce. If you don't go down that route, then the only other solution is to adopt the American model, which is you under-provide and you have immigration rules which allow you to top up with everybody else's labour production. Now, whether that's ethical, given what those countries have put into medical, the undergraduate medical training, for example, I think is questionable. So I recognise it's a dark art workforce planning. I think you've got to try and do it as well as you can. I think you've got to have some central oversight and control to ensure that the no specialty becomes suffers. I think that core training should happen everywhere. But there should be more competition in terms of where high specialist training occurs to drive up quality.
Thank you.
challenging equations to solve.
We're having a very good discussion, which is going to be perfect. The suit's not getting cold. But a few more questions, a couple more questions. Bill.
Useful for an audience like this, but how many opportunities do you get to throw this through with sort of 40, 50 of students? Should a talk like this perhaps be put onto CD or DVD so that a much wider range of
right.
students at those times
yeah.
can get to see the important insights you've given?
Yeah. I mean, well, I do think it's important. We're talking about, you know, the next generation's careers here, aren't we? And it's all very well for somebody like me to pontificate, but it does need to be debated with them as well, because, you know, they're the ones who are going to make or break it. I think one of the really invigorating things for me is the way that young medical students possess the desire to affect healthcare. They're vocational. There's a risk that vocation gets bashed out of them. I don't know what your view is, but I'm increasingly of the view that many of them see their vocational aspirations being met in a global context as opposed to a local context. Now, at one level, I think that's inevitable. They see themselves as far more global citizens than perhaps my generation. But I do worry it's because they perhaps perceive there's less opportunity to make a real difference in their careers in the UK. And that would be very sad if that were the case. So yes, I think we do need to start early, we need to engage with them. These are issues that need to be debated very fully, because the role's going to be different to the one that you and I have enjoyed.
I had a comment and a question, but you've answered my question, which was on road substitutes.
I had a brief comment.
The comment is very brief. I was talking to my GP yesterday, and he said medical students, when they're asked, why do you want to do medicine, they must never say, because I want to help people. I was telling my wife this, and she said, what they should say is, for the money.
I'm a GP, and I'm involved in postgraduate education in the Western area. But at this time of year, I go around schools and prepare A-level students for going to university, and they'll go for the Cambridge interviews next week.
Right.
So I have 12 people yesterday and 12 today. And one of my questions always is, you know, do you know about the career structure after you qualify, and where do you see yourself in 10 years? And then I say to them, maybe it's wrong, but I would say, and, you know, what percentage of people do you think do general practice, pediatrics, whatever? And they all want to be GPs if they can't get into pediatrics, brain surgery, or save the world. That's the three main things. And then I say 80% of people end up in general practice, and I find your comment fascinating. That should be in perspective.
Yeah.
They have no idea. And for me, to try and tell a keen 18-year-old where they're going to end up, they don't really believe you.
No, no. Well, we know where kids get their medical insights from, if they, it's not a doctor in the house. They get it from the media. So they have this completely artificial view of what the rate of cardiac resuscitation is, for example.
We should bring back Dr. Finley's casebook.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that that's sort of sad note for endocrinologists, you know, if you're not seeing any of them out there. I think we should really thank Sir John for giving up his time. It's a precious month for him, and our programme was set before he knew about the move, and yet he still came in the midst of this very busy month. It's been very enlightening. I think it's been very interesting. I suppose one of my sadnesses, and I'll probably get into trouble over dinner for this, is that it's not medical education UK, because I'm not sure that the devolved administrations are big enough to carry their own programmes forward, and hopefully we could contribute to MEE as well.
There is that device. I mean, I insisted that, because we weren't allowed to object to DH England,
isolation that there was that was only the UK, but they have now within their constitution the absolute need to relate to the immigration stuff.
That's great, and just to thank Sir John very much.